Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Soundcheck.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. There's never a bad time to mention Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon. I mean, this is a record that stayed on the Billboard charts for a staggering 741 weeks. That's over 14 years. No matter what kind of music you like or how old you are, I bet that either you or someone you know owns or has owned a copy of Dark Side of the Moon. Well, now the Library of Congress has a copy, too. The library has announced its annual list of 25 new entries onto its National Recording Registry, and Pink Floyd's on it. Their press release says, quote, "Oh, wow, man, this record is so groovy. Hey, have you ever really looked at your own hand, man?" Or maybe they said it was of lasting cultural and aesthetic value. I can't remember which. We'll clear that up later when we talk to the curator of the Library of Congress's record collection. And the indie trio Low plays live for us. They're releasing their 10th album and celebrating their 20th anniversary as a band. Plus, our ongoing series, That Was a Hit, gets run off the rails by a song that, surprisingly, wasn't a hit. But first, for decades, this was the sound of late-night TV. That's the Tonight Show Band, led by Doc Severinsen. The big band provided the soundtrack for the show from the 1950s all the way to the mid-90s. But come fall of 2014, the Tonight Show Band could sound like this. Can I get some help now? That's The Roots, the current house band for Late Night with Jimmy Fallon. Now, according to news leaked last week, Fallon will become the new host of The Tonight Show in a year and a half, and the show will be moving back to its ancestral home here in New York City. Joining me on the line from L.A. is Phil Gallo, senior correspondent for Billboard magazine. Phil, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you for having me.
So this is obviously TV news, but you see this as affecting the music industry as well, right?
Absolutely. A key component to them basing the Tonight Show in New York is there will be a lot more competition for the exclusive performances between the Tonight Show and David Letterman show on CBS.
And Jimmy Fallon has really hitched his wagon to music in a big way during his run on Late Night.
Absolutely. He's done a lot of shows that have showcased superstars as well as up-and-comers. He's handed over shows, entire weeks to different artists. Mm-hmm. It's a very, very musical show. It's very different than anything we've seen in Late Night before.
And what about The Roots? I mean, you know, when he first named them as his house band, it was a pretty forward-thinking move, wasn't it?
At the time, it was really out of character for late night television. From the Roots perspective, there was what do they have to gain?
Right.
This is a band that really has thrived at a street level, had a certain audience. Why would they be interested in attracting an audience from a variety show, basically? Instead, it has brought in a lot of fascinating artists to perform with the Roots. It's helped shape the character of the Fallon show, and it's done so in a way that Paul Schaefer did with Letterman, and as you referenced earlier, Doc Severinsen sort of did with Johnny Carson. It's just a very different dynamic, and I think it adds to the sort of the hip factor that you see in Fallon that you don't see in other shows.
Yeah. For example, I mean, talking of the hip factor, this past Friday, the Icelandic band Sigur Rós made their first TV appearance in almost a decade on Late Night with Jimmy Fallon, and they showed up with what looked like, you know, a small orchestra and a set of Asian gongs, and there's Yancey, the lead singer, bowing his guitar. It looked completely unlike what you expect from Late Night TV, and they debuted a new song called Quaker. The Icelandic band Sigur Rós with a song called Quaker from their forthcoming album, which they played live on Late Night with Jimmy Fallon this past Friday. Jimmy Fallon is expected to take over at The Tonight Show by the fall of 2014. We're speaking with Phil Gallo, senior correspondent for Billboard magazine, who's written about this. How big a role has music sort of traditionally played on Jay Leno's version of The Tonight Show?
I would say it's really not that different from what you saw on Johnny Carson. This is a little four-minute segment at the very end of the show. Very rarely do musical acts make their way over to the couch. Mm-hmm. It's still almost an afterthought. And where other shows have gone and really used the internet to expand their musical offerings, whether it's Kimmel or Letterman, or Conan, the Tonight Show has pretty much really emphasized the Hollywood talent, Jay's comedic bits, and comedians.
Right. So do you see, when they do have musicians on the show, do you see a different kind of musician from what we would expect when Fallon takes over?
I mean, the beauty of the Tonight Show is it's number one in the ratings, and by that mere fact, It attracts people who want to be on the show. It's a certain type of act, and it's generally an act that has some commercial capabilities. I think Fallon has gone with a riskier booking policy. That, though, owes to being on at 12:30.
Right.
When you come to 11:30, you need a little bit more name factor in terms of who you're booking. But I think that when you look at the landscape of music today, there's a lot of room for a lot of different types of acts.
Well, recently on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno, I mean, sort of going to what you were saying, Phil, about needing more sort of commercial viability, his guests included the American Idol runner-up, Crystal Bowersox.
Somebody's coming, he's going home, there ain't no use trying to control it, because this ain't easy knowing what's going on. What's the use for love if you can't show it? It's all I've got. Ain't she pretends it's my favorite spot. Sit alone and wonder if I'm living life or not.
Crystal Bowersox, American Idol runner-up, one of the recent acts that you could hear performing and watch performing on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno. It is expected that Leno will make way for Jimmy Fallon by the fall of 2014, and The Tonight Show will then move back to New York. Phil Gallo, senior correspondent for Billboard magazine, you mentioned that The Tonight Show with Jay Leno is still number one, so there is some risk here, replacing Leno with Fallon. Why would NBC do that?
this is something they attempted 5 years ago.
You mean with Conan?
With Conan.
Yeah.
And there's just been this sense that Jay Leno's reign was going to run out, and so they signed him two contracts that would have an endpoint. So they've come to a point in the road where do you sign him up for another number of years or do you sever ties?
Is this a demographic thing?
On one side, it's really inexplicable. You have a network that is really struggling in the ratings anytime you do not have The Voice or Sunday Night Football on.
Mm-hmm.
And you have one area where you dominate, and that's late night. And you choose to say, okay, we're done with what we were doing. We're gonna shake things up. Now, when you look at where late night is in terms of Kimmel developing an audience, you kind of wonder, should we be more like that, get into that sort of game and start to reinvent what late night television is?
Well, now you mentioned Jimmy Kimmel over on ABC. If The Tonight Show moves from the West Coast back to New York, does that leave the whole playing field open for Jimmy Kimmel and ABC?
Pretty much. If you want to be on network television, Jimmy Kimmel is going to be your only option on the West Coast. And Kimmel is already set up to really give superstar treatment to the superstars of music. They have an outdoor concert stage in their backyard. They can close down Hollywood Boulevard and put concerts out. They just signed a new deal with Sony Electronics to sponsor their outdoor concerts. It's a very music-driven show as much as it is about the skits and sketches. You know, by going to New York, Fallon will be able to take what he's already done and expand that.
Now, he's done it on TV, but he's also done it, as Jimmy Kimmel has as well, through internet videos, some of which have gone viral. For example, last year, Jimmy Fallon and his house band, The Roots, in the backstage area of the set, recorded a version of Call Me Maybe with Carly Rae Jepsen and a bunch of toy instruments, and has currently had more than 13 million YouTube views. So that's Jimmy Fallon, Carly Rae Jepsen, and The Roots all packed together backstage in front of the built-in camera on a computer doing this version of Call Me Maybe, which brings up another point, Phil, which is that Jimmy Fallon is, you know, a passable musician and singer himself and is really into, you know, he's not going to be a Tonight Show with the guy spinning plates and the other guy with the animals from the zoo and then a comic and that's your show. I mean, music has become part and parcel of late-night TV. That seems to be what I take away from all of this.
Absolutely, and I think there's an attitude about when Fallon takes the stage at 11:30, that show has to have a certain flavor from 11:30 to midnight. And perhaps those elements of the old Fallon won't be apparent until you hit the 12 o'clock hour.
Yeah. I would hope that those sorts of silly moments are still a part of the mix because it's what's made Fallon so successful already. Jimmy Fallon is expected to take over The Tonight Show by the fall of 2014 on NBC, and they're talking about moving the show back here to New York, putting it in head-to-head competition with David Letterman, among others. And we've been speaking with Phil Gallo, senior correspondent for Billboard magazine. Phil, thanks for bringing us up to speed on all this.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
This is Soundcheck.
Vision dreams of passion
going through my mind,
and all the while I think of you.
Basketball. Basketball is my favorite sport. I like the way they dribble up and down.
That's Jimmy Fallon together with Justin Timberlake performing their fourth History of Rap on Late Night with Jimmy Fallon earlier this month. Now, to my ears, it sounds like they've got those lyrics down pat. But rap is known to be full of misheard lyrics, or mondegreens, to use the fancy term. This week, we've been asking you to tell us about the lyrics that you've gotten wrong over the years. Our listener David in New Jersey called in to tell us about his experience with a mondegreen, a song that he and his daughter used to sing together.
It was a 60s song and was, how did it go? Why do you build me a tropical island just to mess me around? Mess me around, and then worst of all, you never call honey when you say, well, you know, something like that.
Why do you build me a particle, baby, just to let me down?
Don't you hate when that happens? When someone builds you a tropical island just to mess you around? Oh, my God. David, thanks for sharing that with us. And in case you wanted to know, the song, of course, is Build Me Up, Buttercup by The Foundations. Do you have a mondegreen, a misheard lyric that you'd like to share with us? You can call us at 866-939-1612. Up next, the indie trio Low came all the way from Minnesota to play songs for us from their new album, The Invisible Way. This is Soundcheck.
If I could just make it stop, I could tell the whole world to get out of the way. If I could just make it stop, if I could just make it stop.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. The band Low has been the pride of Duluth, Minnesota for 20 years. Their sound is probably best described by the band's own singer and guitarist, Alan Sparhawk, who wrote on their website, "We've made many records and you know our MO. Slow, quiet, sometimes melancholy, and, we hope, sometimes pretty." Well, their newest record, their 10th, is all of those things. But it's also somewhat different in ways that we'll find out about right after the band plays us a song. Here is Low, live on Soundcheck, with Plastic Cup.
You could always count on your friends to get you high. That's right. And you could always count on the rents to get you by. You could fly. And now they make you talk into a plastic cup. The cup will probably be here long after we're gone. What's wrong? They'll probably dig it up a thousand years from. Must be the cup the king held every night as he cried.
Ooh.
band Low, and a live performance in the Soundcheck studio of their song Plastic Cup. It is the lead-off track on their new album called The Invisible Way. You heard Alan Sparhawk singing and playing guitar, Mimi Parker singing and playing the drums. Steve Garrington, the band's bassist and keyboardist, is more than happy to spend this set at our piano. Guys, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Thank you very much. Thanks. Yes, a lot of friends here.
Mimi, the album is called The Invisible Way, mm-hmm. and this opening track kind of sets the mood, it seems, for the whole thing. Is it a different mood from the 9 records that have come before? And by the way, congratulations on your 20th anniversary as a band.
Thank you. You know, I think it's a little different. You know, we're not the same people. We're, you know, we certainly have changed. Everybody does. But at the same time, we're the same people. You know, it's mm-hmm. the same voices. It's the same kind of aesthetic, minimal aesthetic, you know, that we've been kind of achieving for at different times and not always. But
and so 10th album. The release date was, in fact, your 20th anniversary as a band. Was that a coincidence, or did you guys plan that?
Yeah, it was sort of a coincidence, actually.
Okay.
But, yeah, when we were turning it in, and our managers sort of alluded to the fact that it was a 20-year anniversary, so...
Well, you know, it's a nice time to kind of take stock, look mm-hmm. back, what mm-hmm. you've done, where you want to be. And with this new album, you know, there do seem to be some different things. Alan, you worked with Jeff Tweedy of Wilco on producing the record.
Yeah. We've worked with a lot of really great producers and engineers, et cetera, over the years. And we really kind of thrive off of that. And, mm-hmm. and we've known Jeff and the band for a few years, especially Nels Klein, a number of years
back. The guitarist, yeah.
And... I don't know. They have a great studio there. They kind of mentioned put the bug in our ear a few years ago, and we sort of finally stopped by one day when we were going through Chicago and really just fell in love with the place and the sounds that they were getting there, especially with, well, they were working on this Mavis Staples record that's coming
right.
out later this year. And I don't know. He was just the perfect engineer for achieving what we've sort of have always been shooting for, and that's...
Which is very different from Mavis Staples.
Well, I don't know. I mean, if you think of... kind of think we're... Kind
right
think
in there with Mavis?
Yeah, we're sort of doing gospel music more or less all these years. As much of gospel music
backdoor,
band as we are punk
gospel.
Band.
Well, now, Mimi, you're singing 5 of the 11 songs on this new record, which is, you know, that's also a little bit of a... I mean, mm-hmm. you've always had one or two featured songs in the past. What was behind that?
Honestly, you know, Alan has kind of been encouraging me to write more and, you know, and take more of that lead vocal. So I guess it was the right time. I had enough time to work on songs and it just fell together.
We're speaking with the members of the band Low. Their new album is called The Invisible Way, their 10th record, out now. Alan, it has been 20 years, which means that when you guys formed, 1993, that's the kind of the height of the grunge era. How difficult was it to put across this?
I don't know. I mean, I think history probably looks back at that time as the grunge era, but really, like, I mean, they're really what happened with Nirvana and that sort of explosion that happened there basically opened the door for a lot of independent bands
sure.
to go out around and tour, and suddenly people were excited about weird music, and there mm-hmm. was kind of a little couple of years there where it really brought people out. And to be honest, that was, I mean, it was really an ideal time to start a band. I mean, as we're different from what was, you know,
a lot of loud bands,
yeah, a lot
and
of
you
loud
guys...
bands, and people trying to outdo each other in that world. But but you know, we knew what we were getting into, and.
Mm-hmm. I mean, was it weird to go into a rock club that was used to, at the time, you know, as you say, bands trying to outdo each other, amps up to 11, and then you guys come in and, you know.
Yeah, he made the statement, we knew what we were getting into. We had no idea what we were getting into. No, we had no idea. You know, we were these naive kids from northern Minnesota, for crying out loud. Yeah, you know, we'd go to these rock clubs, and we knew they were, half the people weren't. You know, they weren't there to see us. Well, none of the people were there to see us. And we just decided from the beginning, all right, we're just going to barrel through mm-hmm. in our quiet, mousy way.
And 20 years later, still barreling through, the new record is called The Invisible Way. Should we hear another song?
All right,
let's hear Holy Ghost. This is the band Low performing live on Soundcheck. Holy Ghost, the name of the song, a new one from the band Low from their latest record called The Invisible Way. And let's hear another song. This also is from the new record, The Invisible Way. Here's Low with a song called Clarence White.
Thank you. It hurts to hear, but it's so easy to say. Clarence White, I know I shouldn't be afraid. You think it's pretty?
Clarence White is the name of the song, live performance in our soundcheck studio by the band Low. Alan Sparhawk singing and playing guitar, Mimi Parker on drums and singing as well, Steve Garrington playing our piano. Clarence White appears on the new album, The Invisible Way. And Alan, the song Clarence White, is that in any way about the ex-Birds guitarist?
It is not. Sometimes songs... It's sort of like how, well, I don't want to compare myself to McCartney necessarily, but the song Yesterday originally was Scrambled Eggs right. when he woke up and wrote it, and then he changed the lyrics later to Yesterday. And when I wrote that, that was Clarence White and Josh Murray was the first phrase that sort of fell out of the ether, and I thought, well, that's interesting. I'm sure I'll change that later. Once I finished the song, and it still made sense to me, at least. So,
the new album is Low, The Invisible Way. It's out now. Guys, thanks so much for coming back in and playing for us on Soundcheck today.
Thank you.
This is Soundcheck. Head over to our website, soundcheck.org. You can see not one, but two videos that we shot of the songs performed by Low right here in our studio. Coming up next, the Library of Congress recently announced this year's picks for the National Recording Registry. We'll take a listen to a few of the notable ones. And it's time for another edition of That Was a Hit. Except this time, we're turning the concept on its head. You'll see what I mean in just a bit. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Every year since 2002, the National Recording Registry at the Library of Congress has added 25 recordings of cultural significance to their registry. They've just announced this year's inductees, which span from 1918 to 1980, and include artists like Artie Shaw, The Ramones, Philip Glass, It brings the total collection up to 375 recordings, and joining us to discuss the 2012 inductees is Matthew Barton. He's the curator of recorded sound at the Library of Congress. Matt, this is getting to be an annual thing. Thanks for being with us. Yeah,
isn't it? I should plan a New York vacation around this sometime.
Now, we're talking about the 2012 inductees for 2013, right?
Mm-hmm.
So some basics here. Who does the nominating and the ultimate selecting of the 25 annual recordings that get into the registry?
The ultimate selections are made by the Librarian of Congress, Dr. James Billington. The nominations come from the public, and they also come from the recording board of the Library of Congress, which is includes employees of the Library of Congress, but also professionals from various parts of the music business.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a, as we get to the end of the 12-month period, there's a deliberative process, and the nominations are finalized by the librarian.
Okay, and then once a recording is on the National Recording Registry, what does that actually mean?
Well, nothing, magic happens at that moment, except that a recording might be getting more attention than it has in many years.
Mm-hmm.
But, at our end, what we try to do is, seek out the master recording or the best possible copy, which is usually what you have to do with something, from the early days of recording and into the 40s and 50s often, and make that a part of the collection. We don't necessarily acquire the master, but we try to get a optimal high-resolution copy from whoever has possession of that master.
Right. So the oldest one for this year's list, and again, this year being 2012, going into the Library of Congress in 2013, the oldest recording is from 1918, Marion Harris. There is no way you're going to find a master tape of that, so you just get the best quality.
Well, there was no tape,
first of all,
in 1918. You'd be looking for a metal stamper or something of that sort. And there actually are some items like that still in the world. I don't think her recording is one of them. So, yes, we'd be looking for an optimal copy. I'm happy to say that that's one we already have, though.
Now, you talk about getting the optimal copy of each recording. One of the albums that's on this year's list is the opera Einstein on the Beach by Philip Glass and Robert Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's been recorded three different times. There's the original kind of edited version that came out on Tomato Records in 79, then later Sony and Nonesuch each did full versions of the opera.
Right.
So how do you make that call?
Well, we were certainly aware of that, and that was part of the deliberations. And it came down to, the initial impact, that this was the Tomato version of it from the late 70s was the one that really put it on the map, so to speak, in popular consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
I was in high school when it came out, and I had no awareness of Philip Glass, but that record was in stores. It really reached a wider audience than recordings of that sort had to that point.
Well, and if we're talking about cultural significance, yes, this 1979 version of Philip Glass's Einstein on the Beach was the one that, as Matthew Barton has told us, introduced a lot of people to the sounds of Philip Glass's music and to this opera in particular called Einstein on the Beach. We're speaking with Matthew Barton. He is the curator of recorded sound at the Library of Congress, and we're talking about this year's selected recordings for the National Recording Registry. So let's talk about some of your highlights, Matt, starting in 1947 with Frank Yankovic. Who is this?
Frank Yankovic and his Yanks. Well, Frank Yankovic is, I don't know that he ever was given that title, but he was very much the king of the polka scene from the late 40s until his death many years later. You know, he was a Slovenian-American. He was in Ohio and was a veteran musician of many years, and he'd absorbed not only his parents' music, but the styles that were all around him. You know, what most Americans thought of as polka was very much a German brass-heavy kind of sound. And, you know, he introduced this style that was very quick and fleet and full of syncopations and ideas that came from pop and jazz music. He's very much a fusion artist, I guess you'd say.
and a particularly American one.
Yes.
This is Frank Yankovic and his Yanks with Just Because.
Just because you think you're so pretty, just because you think you're so hot, just because you think you've got something that nobody else has got. You've caused me to spend all my money. You've laughed and called me old Sandy.
Frank Yankovic and his Yanks from 1947. The song Just Because is now part of the Library of Congress's National Recording Registry. Culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant recordings from the years 1918 to 1980. Do the recordings need to be a certain age before they're eligible for the registry?
They need to be 10 years old or more.
Okay.
That's really the only chronological requirement.
Well, the most recent one, and also on your list of highlights from this year, is Betty Carter, the jazz singer, from 1980. What is the significance of the audience with Betty Carter?
Well, I've always loved that title,
instead
of just Betty Carter Live, which everybody, you know, has an album out that just is their name with Live at the end of it. You know, she picked that name, and I think it was because, you know, she knew that she was at her best in front of an audience, the right kind of audience. And by 1979, she'd been in the business close to 30 years, and it was often a frustrating business for her. But in the 70s, she was really able to take control of her career. She started her own label, Bette Carr, and was issuing albums. And the audience with Betty Carter is, it's not a single performance. It's drawn from three nights in San Francisco. But, you know, you can just hear her, reaching a peak. You know, and, you know, reaching out to the audience responding, and you know, in a, you know, the late 70s was not a great time to be a jazz singer, yet that's when she broke through.
So this is Betty Carter with the 1980 record, The Audience with Betty Carter.
So make your choice, and you do your thing. That your grass, it will turn green. Believe, get the picture going straight. You gotta be on the case. You gotta stay on the move.
Betty Carter, Sounds, Moving On is the name of the song, the album, The Audience with Betty Carter from 1980, the most recent recording on this year's list of inductees into the Library of Congress's National Recording Registry. Matthew Barton, the curator of Recorded Sound there at the Library of Congress, joining us as he does around this time each year on Soundcheck. Lots of stuff from the 70s, Matt. Bee Gees, Saturday Night Fever, the first Ramones record, the Wild Chapultepec, the Mardi Gras Indian tribe. I mean, this is kind of a kind of a cross-section of American music and culture of the 70s, isn't it?
Yeah, some of which was, of course, enormously popular, like Saturday Night Fever, and other things which, you know, reached a smaller audience, like the Ramones, or only reached a very local audience, like the Wild Chapultepec in New Orleans, yet they have endured.
And all three, you know, with very long musical legacies. Here's just a brief clip from each.
Away.
The Wild Chapatoulas with Brother John. You heard a little bit of the Ramones' Blitzkrieg Bop and the Bee Gees' Stayin' Alive. All of those recordings issued in 1976-77, all of them now part of the Library of Congress's National Recording Registry, which each year adds 25 new recordings to the library's registry. And each year, Matthew Barton talks us through some of them on Soundcheck. You can visit our website for a complete list of this year's 25 new additions to the Library of Congress at soundcheck.org. And Matt, you started by telling us that, you know, in terms of nominating, there's like a group of professionals from the music industry and stuff, but that there's also, you know, the public gets involved. There is one record on the list this year that I have to assume was very much a public nominating favorite, and that is Dark Side of the Moon by Pink Floyd.
Yes, absolutely, very much so. And you know, of course, Pink Floyd is a British group.
Yeah.
But you know, what an impact they had. That record, you know, is still selling today.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really you know, inescapable, I think.
Right. So even though they're British, still culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant here in the States.
Right, right.
Okay.
Now there are a handful of other British groups and also recordings from other countries on the registry. It is dominated by American recordings, but you know, there's the line is not always stark. It's not always a black and white distinction.
All right, Matthew Barton is the curator of recorded sound at the Library of Congress. Matt, thanks so much for joining us again this year.
My pleasure. See you next year.
It's not what we would choose.
A little bit of Us and Them from Pink Floyd's 1973 album Dark Side of the Moon, which, as we just heard, is now officially a part of the National Recording Registry at the Library of Congress.
And now, Soundcheck looks back at the pop charts of yesteryear and asks,
that was a hit?
Everybody was kung fu fighting.
They're coming to take me away, haha.
Joining us for this week's edition of That Was a Hit is music writer and NPR music contributor Chris Malanfi. Chris, welcome back. Not your first time on this series.
Right.
But at your request or at your suggestion, we're turning the series on its head and calling it That Wasn't a Hit?
Right.
Why are we doing this?
When friends come over to my apartment and they look at my shelf of Billboard books that can list every hit they've ever had, the first thing they do is they pull a book off the shelf and they look up their favorite artist. And a good percentage of the time they go, wait a minute, how is this not a hit? You know, they'll flip to the page where the Pixies should be or the Smiths and say, the Smiths never had a Hot 100 hit. That's insane, you know. So I find that just as much of the time as people are marveling that these bizarre songs were hits, they're also marveling that these unbelievably catchy, wonderful songs that we consider gold now were not hits, often for bizarre reasons or inexplicable reasons. So I thought we should do the flip side of That Was a Hit.
Okay, so this wasn't a hit. What this are we talking about?
Well, we could have started with many different types of songs, but the one that I always bring up because it boggles my mind because it's such a catchy song is Tempted by Squeeze.
But that song was everywhere.
You'd think that. Tempted by Squeeze, it's from their fourth album, East Side Story, famously an album produced by Elvis Costello. Elvis Costello actually sings a line in the song. It's a piece of blue-eyed soul, so it was a bit of a change-up for the band. They were, you know, a post-punk slash new wave band.
Mm-hmm. From England.
From England, fronted by the, you know, new Lennon-McCartney of Glenn Tilbrook and Chris Difford. They wrote a string of very catchy songs. They'd yet to break the charts in America, and they did actually break the Hot 100 with this song, but it peaked at an incredibly modest number 49.
Wow, so it didn't hit the top 40.
It didn't make the top 40. And it's their first American hit of any kind, which is also mind-blowing when you consider how many unbelievably catchy songs they had. I often say to people, the reason MTV had to come along and create the second British Invasion was because there was just such a wave of great British, not just rock, but pop, catchy songs. And these songs were not hits here. And Tempted is a signal example of that. This should have been a massive hit.
I can't believe it wasn't. I guess that's kind of the point.
Right.
The song is Tempted from 1981 by the band Squeeze.
I'm at the car park, the airport, the baggage carousel.
The people keep on grabbing,
and wishing I was well.
I said it's no occasion,
it's no story.
My bedside empty pocket, a foot without a sock. Your body gets much closer, I fumble for the clock. Alarmed by the seduction, I wish that it would stop. Tempted by the fruit of another, tempted but the truth is discovered. What's been going on now that you have gone? There's no other.
The song is Tempted by the band Squeeze, and it was not a hit in 1981. Chris Melanfi with us on Soundcheck and turning our series That Was a Hit upside down with a song that feels like a hit, sounds like a hit. I thought it was a hit. Why didn't it break the top 40?
It's anyone's guess. I mean, you know, you normally when a song like this isn't a hit in America, if you're an Anglophile pop fan like I am, you stick your nose up in the air and sniff. Well, at least the British have better taste than we do. It wasn't a hit in England either. It peaked at number 41 in England, which makes no sense. And by then, Squeeze had hits in England like Take Me, I'm Yours. You know,
the whole album Cool for Cats was just one catchy song.
One catchy song, Cool for Cats, was a hit. Up the Junction was a number two hit.
Yeah.
They'd had hits in England. For some reason, the British didn't cotton on to this either. I think it's because it was a change-up. This was the first and pretty much only album where the vocalist, the blue-eyed soul vocalist, Paul Carrack, sings lead. Paul Carrack is a strange character. He's basically sung on a slew of good pop records, and he rarely stays with a band very long. In the 70s, he had a huge hit here in America called How Long with the band Ace, and that reached number three on our charts. Later in the mid-80s, he joined Mike Rutherford of the band Genesis in a band called Mike and the Mechanics. They had a top 10 hit with him singing lead called Silent Running. Later, they had a number one hit with him singing lead called The Living Years. So Paul Carrack has had hits. Bizarrely, this song, which I would argue is better than any of the ones I just ticked off, is the least of them on the charts, either here or in England.
And produced by Elvis Costello, who heard singing one of the lines in that verse.
The people keep on crying.
Yeah.
Yeah, that line is Elvis.
And he wouldn't have a top 40 hit for another couple of years either.
That's correct. I mean, yet again, another artist, you know, a great British artist who needed to break in America. His first top 40 hit in America was Every Day I Write the Book in 1983, which finally broke him into the top 40. Not very high. I think it made the mid-30s.
Mm.
He didn't even get into the top 20, I believe, until Veronica in the late 80s. So it took Elvis a while to break, too.
Is it all in that pretty little head of yours? What goes on in that place in the dark? Well, I used to know a girl, and I could have sworn that her name was Veronica. Well, she used to have a carefree mind of her own and a delicate look in her eyes. These days, I'm afraid she's not even sure if her name is Veronica.
So, if we're talking about Squeeze and Tempted and how that wasn't a hit,
right,
at what point does Squeeze actually get a genuine top 40 hit?
Here in America, they got it finally in 1987 with a song that is largely forgotten. It's a strange little ditty called Hourglass. It's not that strange, but it's strange that this is their breakthrough hit. It made our top 20. And it's pretty catchy. It's kind of a brain virus, if you will, where Difford and Tilbrook are singing these incredibly fast lines. This is an insult. I don't mean it to sound this ridiculous, but it's kind of like One Week by Bare Naked Ladies 12 years before One Week. They're singing this chorus that goes, take it to the bridge, throw it overboard, see if it can swim, back up to the shore. And that was their breakthrough in America, pretty much toward the end of their fruitful period.
Yeah.
But yeah, all the great Squeeze songs, Black Coffee in Bed, Annie Get Your Gun, pulling muscles from a shell. None of them were top 40 hits here.
Wow. Hourglass was, but as Chris Melanfi tells us, it was no tempted. Chris, thank you for taking our series and wringing the juices out of it and turning it into something else.
My pleasure.
Chris Melanfi with us on Soundcheck. That's going to do it for Soundcheck today. Tomorrow on the show, Lonely Planet's U.S. editor presents a Hudson Valley rock and roll day trip. It includes stops inspired by the late Levon Helm and the B-52's Kate Pearson. And live music from Tao and the Get Down Stay Down. They'll play songs from their new album, We the Common. See you back here tomorrow night at 9. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.